Hey, Outdoor Explorers. The program we're bringing you today comes from the Outdoor Explorer Archives. This show on geocaching is one of our favorites from the fall of 2014, and we're happy you're here to enjoy it with us one more time. Here we go.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I had a ton of fun last week with my daughter, an iPhone app, and a treasure hunt. We were geocaching, which amounts to looking for hidden caches logged on a website using GPS equipment. It's a bit addictive, and a lot of people are doing it. A day after my daughter and I were crashing around through the bushes by the coastal trail looking for a cache, I saw a group of guys looking for the same one as I ran by, but I knew what they were up to. If you haven't tried geocaching, you'll probably want to after today's show. If you have tried it, you've come to the right place to learn more and to get some tips and additional ideas, because we have a fantastic panel of geocachers in the studio. And these are three enthusiastic guys who are really into doing this, and I think you're going to enjoy meeting them. Scott Sagreaves, Mike Malvick, and Robert Burton. They're all involved in these organizations, Geocache Alaska, geocachealaska.org, Groundspeak. And they're all enthusiasts for geocaching. And let me start with you, Scott. What appeals to you about this? Because if you hear about it, you're going to go find something that, you know, what's the point, right? What makes it fun?
Well, it's a treasure hunt, just like when you're a kid. A little bit more advanced, get longitude and latitude, plug it into a GPS, and head to your location and start searching for a container. That's what's fun about it. It's a treasure hunt, just like being a kid.
And it doesn't matter too much what's in there, right? I mean, because a lot of times there's nothing. You're just logging that you found it, right?
Right. In fact, there's always a log sheet in them. Generally, there's always a log sheet that you're required to sign. But larger containers will have trade items, especially for the kids. Toys. You take a toy, you put something of equal or greater value into it.
Oh, okay, cool. So, Mike Malvick, you are sort of involved kind of in organizing this. People find the geocaches on the website. I mean, it's a sport that would not exist without the internet and GPSs. It's technology-based in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so what's unique about it is you start in front of your computer, but then you actually have to push away from your computer and go outside to participate in it. So it's a mix of the nerdy online gaming aspect, but then the game itself is actually outside.
Yeah, we talk a lot on the show about how to get your kid away from the computer and outdoors, and this is a good, tricky way to do it, I think.
Yes, it is. A lot of families leverage that.
Yeah, my daughter really enjoyed it. She was doing it in a class at school, and then she kind of got me into it, and we had fun and found out all I needed was my phone of, 30 seconds to download an app, and I was away I went. And it seems like, somebody has put all these caches out there. I guess that's part of the sport, is putting the caches in place?
Yeah, the game is played, and the players keep the game going. So it's actually a very successful, for lack of a better term, a pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm. You have to participate, and the players grow the game themselves. And the player participation is to the point where now there are over 2 million caches around the world.
Wow.
6 million players. The United States is going to roll over its millionth active geocache in the next week or two. Groundspeak's going to make a big announcement when that happens. Just sitting within 20 miles of where we are in the studio, there are over 3,000 geocaches just in the greater Anchorage, Eagle River, Matsu Valley area. So the game's really
grown. That was
something
that blew my mind. It's like I go on the phone, like we went on the website first, I guess, and said, well, how far do we have to go to find one? And like there's one. Just jump on our bikes. There's one like within a quarter of a mile. They're all over the place.
Yes, that's correct. And a lot of it is what's fun about it for a lot of people is it takes them to places they otherwise wouldn't go. There was a group of cachers about 7 years ago who made it a goal to put a cache in every municipal park in Anchorage. There are more than 100 municipal parks in Anchorage, and some of them are in really nice locations I otherwise mm-hmm. wouldn't have found. And that's the appeal to the game for me is the location-based. I've found geocaches in all 50 states, 20 countries.
Oh, my gosh.
My business trip to Texas, I'm working with some Texan cachers on finding a geocache in every Texan county. So,
oh, my gosh, that's
in conjunction with the business trip, so it's all
that's
about...
That's going to take you some dry, dusty places, right?
It's all about location and meeting the people, with like-minded, outdoor-oriented people. And it's, you know, think of it as an online... Europe through the back door, Maui through the back door, way to discover new places.
So, Robert Burton, you're also a board member with Geocache Alaska. How did you get into this?
Actually, we found the first one by accident, which a lot of people do find them and they go, what is this? It was a container under an orange cone on top of a fence post that I had put out for a marker for a truck driver. And I forgot to get it, and 6 months later, I went back to get it, picked it up in there, and there was a little container,
like a
lock
little,
and lock box.
Some little human squirrel had put something
there. Yes, that's right. And we opened it up, and we go, what is this? And so that was the first introduction to it, and then about...
So how did you figure out what it was?
Inside, there's a little piece, the log is there, and it's and a lot of them, if they're big enough, will have a piece of paper, business card size or bigger, that tells you it's a geocache. And to do not take something, leave something, do not remove the geocache itself. And so we did that. And then about 6 months, a year later, my wife went on a business trip with another person in her office that she didn't know that was a geocacher. And then they went for a walk instead of hitting all the bars and started geocaching. And she came back and told me about it. And she knows that... I don't like walking around the same block every day to get out and do her walking with her. And so we incorporate walking, and I like using my mind and finding something and my eyes and my mind to coordinate them. And so we go out, and every day of the year you can go out and geocache in Alaska or anywhere in the world. And so that's how we got into it.
Isn't it amazing? And it's something that seems like it's very social, and that it's been... by word of mouth is how this sport has actually come into existence. Like people tell, hey, it's fun. Try it, right?
Yes, we tell people all the time. And we just, I was in Cabela's talking to them, and they're having a ladies' function on October 4th, and they've asked us to come in and help them promote the geocaching in their store.
So what kind of equipment do you use? Do you have a high caliber GPS, or do you just like use a phone, or what do you?
I have a high caliber GPS, yes,
because you're quite into it by now.
Yes, yeah, I'm not the highest number, but I have 4,500 caches found.
Wow,
that I've logged, and I know there's another 500 that I find and I forget to log them, and it doesn't happen. My wife, she uses her smartphone, and sometimes she does better than I do. But
does the computer keep track of your like how many you've found and all that?
Yes, yeah, so after you find them, you go back and you upload your finds or go to the cache that you find and type in the web page you found it. And we like to tell a little story about it. And some people tell better stories or more elaborate stories than others. And that gets very exciting just reading the stories on them sometimes.
So I would think that would get rather competitive, right? Who's found the most?
It can be competitive. It was at one point for some people. And
all right, so let's see who has, you had said 4,000, how many?
4,500.
All right, so we're going to turn to Scott. How many?
I have 2,164.
Okay, and Mike?
I have 7,600.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, those aren't necessarily high fine counts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the world leader right now has over 100,000 geocache fines.
Does he do anything else?
He actually does have a full-time software-based job.
Oh, wow.
But it allows him to do a lot of traveling around the world. He's actually been to Alaska twice in the last 2 years because he enjoys it up here.
Yeah. So, Scott, tell me about the social aspect of this. It sounds like it's more than just going out on your own and finding something.
You know, I've never met the nicest people than the I've never met a geocacher that I didn't like.
Uh-huh.
We're actually really lucky here in Alaska with the community that we have. And we have a lot of social event get-togethers, whether it's just to meet for breakfast. Everybody keeps it real kid-friendly and fun and funny. Everybody just gets along. It's a fun sport.
Because it's not that big a deal, right?
No, it isn't. Uh-huh. We all know we're kind of geeky, and we're fine with that.
have to say, I mentioned in the intro that I went out and my daughter and I were looking for this geocache, which we actually didn't find that one, beating around in the bushes in the coastal trail, and people are coming by looking at us thinking like, what the heck are those people doing? The next day I was out on my run, and there's like six grown men kicking the bushes around in the exact same spot, which I would have thought was really weird if I hadn't been there. You got some funny looks?
Oh, you do get funny looks. And we actually have a term for people who aren't playing the game, but catch us searching for something, and we call them muggles.
Oh, it's like Harry Potter.
Yeah, right. Perfect. So you're always trying to stay inconspicuous and using tools and being sneaky to not be seen, such as wearing a vest, a reflective vest. Maybe they think you're a worker.
I didn't think of that. So just that adds a sort of a bit of espionage to the thing.
Yeah, right.
So tell me about these gatherings where folks get together. How does that work?
That is another type of cache that you can find, not just a traditional type cache, but an event cache is a social get-together where you're not necessarily trying to find a container and sign the log sheet within it, but you're just getting together socially, whether it's a Christmas party. And you get that counted as a find, just like if you found a regular container.
But you have to be there at a specific
time
as
well
as a location.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right.
So what would describe what one of these would be like?
Well, one time at we have these cleanup events too, social events where we clean up the area. And one event that I put on was a circus type event where we had skits put on. You know, we're trying to get people to come out and help us clean up the area. So little skits put on. We had a clown there. We dressed one of the kids up as a clown. Everybody got a big red clown nose and we took a group photo afterwards. What else have we done?
Well, that sounds great.
Well, one thing we do on a nearly monthly basis is we offer an education event over at the BP Energy Center, usually the third Thursday at 7 o'clock. And the event topics range from introductions to geocaching to some of the more advanced software applications that are part of the game to how to find a cache, how to hunt a cache.
And folks can find out about all this through our website at alaskapublic.org. We've got links to all the sites you're going to hear about, and there are certainly a lot of sites, and it's really critical for this particular topic to get on these sites and find out what it's all about. We're talking about geocaching on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and my three guests are Mike Malvick, who was just speaking. Before him, you heard from Scott Saygraves and Robert Burton. Mike, explain how the website works. I mean, you go on the website and there's kind of a map there. Who puts that there?
The website is owned and operated by Groundspeak. They're a Seattle-based company that is privately held by the original three founders.
And is that sort of the only geocaching website? Are there others? Or
there are other minor sites that have come and gone and are still around that one can find online, but geocaching.com is definitely the biggest site out there and the most active.
And it makes sense for everybody to go through one because then it's sort of more organized, I would think. I mean, keep track of your how many you've found and all that.
That's correct, because the geocaching.com website, as you log your finds, it keeps track of how many caches you have logged as found. It also track caches that you haven't found if you write a log, if you had an unsuccessful hunt. And there are a variety of other types of logs that one can write online, too. Mm.
So does it cost anything to use the site?
People can entry into the game is free. Anybody with a computer or the smartphone app can log on to the site and look up geocaches and start hunting within a few minutes of first seeing the site. And then there is another level of membership with Groundspeak called a premium membership that costs $20 a year that gives you what are called premium member benefits, such as the ability to download and filter literally hundreds or thousands of caches at a time. It allows you to award favorite points to geocaches. It allows you to hide caches and put a premium member-only status on it so only other premium members can see it. And one of the benefits of that is you get an audit log on that link on the page, so you can click and look and see who's looked at your cache page and at least read it, and might be, if it's a tricky puzzle you've put up front that somebody has to solve to get the coordinates, you can see who's working on the puzzle as well.
Neat. So I guess they make their money through the premium members, but somebody who just wants to hide a cache and put it on the website, anybody can do it?
That's correct. So all they have to do is validate their email address. You create an account. They, just like a lot of other websites, you get an email back that says, click this link to validate this email, and then you can hide a cache. But it's recommended that somebody actually find several caches first so they get a sense of, you know, container types that work, locations that work, types of hiding or camouflage techniques, so their geocache actually lasts for a while.
So in terms of quality control, is anybody sort of checking to make sure that the caches are valid and that kind of thing, that they've used the right coordinates or anything like that? Or is it just sort of a self-checking thing? Nobody can find it. It obviously isn't any good.
Well, the first quality control check occurs before the cache is published online. And Groundspeak has a crew of about 300 worldwide volunteers that review geocaches before they're published.
So that's something you do for Alaska?
Yes, I do that for Alaska. And what I do when I review an Alaskan cache is I check for compliance with Groundspeak's guidelines. And they've got some fairly basic guidelines, like place the cache with adequate permission. Don't bury the cache. This isn't a buried treasure hunt. We don't want people running around the woods with shovels looking for something.
Right.
Don't place it on school grounds where faculty and students and parents might be concerned. Avoid government buildings where security people are going to be concerned about people wandering around with electronic devices. Nothing on airport property.
Okay.
You know, some things that seem common sense, some things that are more subtle.
And so it's mostly going to be in public parks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Public parks, public parking lots. We have a good relationship with Alaska State Parks. So we have a blanket permit to place caches, for instance, in Chugach State Park.
Okay.
And that's another thing that I, as the reviewer, check for, is one of the stipulations for the permit is that the permit number be on the cache page in the geocache.
So, Robert, what is? It sounds like there's different levels of difficulty. And what are some of the harder and easier caches? I mean, what determines the level of difficulty?
There's two difficulty ratings. One is terrain rating, and one is the hide rating itself.
So, how hard is it to find, basically?
Correct.
I got you.
And so, like, we went to Hawaii on one. We had to climb up four waterfalls and swim across the pond from one waterfall to get to where the cache was hidden.
Wow.
It was a beautiful, beautiful area to go through, and we never would have known it wasn't for geocaching, but it had a terrain rating of 5.
You'd be pretty mad if it wasn't there.
Yes. And of course we did find it, and then the difficult rating can be, you know, if it's just sitting in plain sight. So many times they're in plain sight, people just don't see them because they're painted to match up.
Well, we found one that was a bolt that had been stuck into a street sign, and you pulled it out, and then there was a little tube, and inside that little tube was the. So I thought that was clever. And another one that was an object that had made to look like a rock and had been hollowed out, so the thing was inside there. I thought there must be somebody manufacturing these things.
Well, that's like the fake rock for keys. It's the same thing. And yes, you can go online or you can go to the geocaching store here in town and buy those also.
Oh, there's a store?
Yes, the AccuPoint, I think it is, that sells stuff here in town.
REI and AccuPoint are two local businesses, and then Geocache Alaska has its own online and physical store that we roll around to events.
Okay. So you're talking about the difficulty, like, and there could also be more difficult because somebody's hidden it really, really well.
Oh, very well. Some of them we've been back to 3 or 4 times.
Really?
Yes. Yes. And then that makes it very, very difficult. And then you also, I don't know if you know that there's also 4 or 5 different types of caches.
Okay.
There's puzzle caches, there's mystery caches, we work with a geological society, I think it is, Mike.
There's an earth cache type called an earth cache where there's no physical container. To log a find, one has to has to answer some location-specific questions and email those answers to the cache owner, and that's GroundSpeak partnered with the Geological Society of America to create
that.
Oh,
how fun. So it's like what you found a site with some geological feature that you're answering questions about, essentially?
Yeah, immediate local examples are there's an earth cache that goes into details about Potter Marsh, how it was formed by the railroad and its subsequent life cycle as it silts in.
So you could learn a lot,
yes. And there's a series of earth caches about the 1964 earthquake and visiting the terrain features that were created by that quake.
So what are the you said a puzzle cache, so you solve a puzzle and then what, find out then the next one to go to or something like that?
Right. The puzzle cache, there's lots of different varieties of the puzzle cache, anywhere from reading a sign on a bench and taking the letters and converting them to numbers by directions on the information on the web page, which is downloaded to your GPS if you have a paperless kind. And then you take those numbers and convert them, and then you go to where the hide is. And there's other ones that get so sophisticated that there's one that here in Alaska that hasn't been found yet because nobody's been able to break the code. And the gentleman that made it up passed away, so he's got the only answer. Except for Mike, he knows where the final is. But
you're not telling.
Well, and actually, while it's true I review final locations, it's just when I do the review process, it's just a set of numbers. I don't.
Does that take away some of the fun for you that you're reviewing them and make it less fun to find them?
Not really, because for a traditional cache, the GPS has its own built-in error. So when you get someplace, it's not going to take you to the geocache.
Maybe within about 30 feet or so.
Yeah. On a good day, in the spruce and birch forest. Sometimes you get lucky and you're within 10 feet accuracy on the GPS. And then we've got some local people that are extremely good with natural and artificial camouflage that make it even harder to find the container. And then for the multi-caches and the puzzle caches, the review process has been designed by GroundSpeak so that the reviewer doesn't necessarily see the solution. It's just a general idea with a satellite photo on a map and check against boundaries and permit conditions for state parks or something like that. So in the end, I still have to solve the puzzle the old-fashioned way and then go hunt it. And to expand a bit on what Robert was saying, some of the puzzles are very sophisticated cryptology, graphic manipulation, stenography, a lot of online things that have to be done in order to get the solution.
So, Scott, what's the hardest one you found?
Well, there's a couple different types of
art.
Well, and climbing mountains to get to them. Those are hard ones for me.
Oh, my gosh.
I generally don't do the puzzle caches because they're hard for me.
Yeah, I think I get a little frustrated.
Give me the coordinates to get to, and I'll get there. We just climbed Castle Mountain, to the base of Castle Mountain a couple weekends ago, going after a cache. So that was a difficult one.
Did you find it?
When we did find it.
When I was doing this, and it was years and years ago, there was one that was on a tiny little island out in the middle of Prince William Sound. And just get to this island was not, you had to go in this lagoon, and then you'd like high up and climb up on the island. I suppose that people probably try to make them as weird a place as possible in some cases, huh?
Well, like Mike said before, a lot of times they're destination points. So you found a really scenic area, you want to introduce some other people to it. That's a good place for a cache.
What about I don't know who wants to take this, but do you ever have situations where somebody's put it in a dangerous spot or like it's too hard to get to and it might be dangerous for people. So you just have to use your own judgment.
I'm not climbing the tree to the very top. I might go halfway up, but I ain't going to the top.
Yeah,
and GroundSpeak's very clear about that, where each geocacher takes on their own risk. There's no liability. They're just a listing service, and it's really up to the individual to decide whether or not they're going to attempt a certain geocache. It's just like a whitewater paddler or rock climber or somebody. There's always a risk assessment about, can I do this and come back intact?
Well, it really is fun, and it sounds like a lot more fun than I even knew. So we're going to be talking in the second half more about geocaching, how you can get involved in some of these crazy places, and what some of the issues are with having people going all over the place, and land access and all that. It really is fun, and it's sort of one of those invisible things. If you don't know about it, you don't even know this is going on. So stick with us, and we'll be back with my three guests, Scott Seagreaves, Mike Malvick, and Robert Burton, when we return. But first, it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar, and our go-to family outdoors person and expert is Aaron Kirkland, the author of Alaska on the Go, Exploring the 49th State with Children, and she's also the publisher of the AK on the Go website. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Welcome to Spring, Outdoor Explorers. I'm Aaron Kirkland, publisher of akonthego.com, here with your April family calendar of events and activities in Alaska's great outside spaces. Hop over to Eagle River Nature Center Saturday, April 4th at 2 p.m., where naturalists won't be hunting for Easter eggs. They'll be looking for signs of spring. Kids kindergarten through sixth grade are welcome to join a one-mile walk and scavenger hunt. Also at the Nature Center is a family hike on Saturday, April 18th at 2 p.m. Dress for the weather, bring snacks and water, and join other families in a springtime adventure. Both events are free, but parking is $5 for non-members. Visit ernc.org for more information. Kids to Parks Day is coming up on May 16th, but now is the time to register your family's pledge to visit a local, state, or national park in an effort to bring all children into the great outdoors. Pledge today at kidstoparks.org and be entered to win a Nikon Coolpix camera. It's free and a perfect way to jump into summer. The wildly popular Mighty Bikes is accepting registrations for 2015 Summer Mountain Biking in Anchorage. Held Tuesday and Thursday evenings, June through August, Mighty Bikes teaches kids ages 8 to 18 the fundamentals of mountain biking and lifelong physical fitness. New to the program? Stay tuned to mightybikes.org for lottery information or email them at info@mightybikes.org for more info. And speaking of bikes, I'm thrilled to have Tom Burek in the studio with me today to talk about a new form of mountain biking that is taking Alaska and I think the country by storm. Tom is longtime director of Trailside Discovery Camp in Anchorage, but he also manages partnerships among other organizations to get kids outside. Now on Fat Tire Bikes. Tom, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
So first, let's talk about the popularity of these things, because I saw them everywhere this winter. So why this is also, you know, so important, because we didn't have a lot of snow, did we, this year?
Right. So the bikes are built for snow, but they can be ridden all year round. And since in Anchorage in particular, we had a lack of snow, people went out and purchased bikes so they could get out. Hence, a lot of people out on trails having fun riding the bikes.
So how many were you able to get? And now these are for kids, right?
Right. So Trailside Discovery Camp started a new program, Keep On Rolling. Mm-hmm. And we worked with the Rasmussen Foundation 907 Bikes to come up with 15 Fat Tire bikes that are used in our outreach programs and summer camp programs. We worked with 21st Century programs, after school programs, and we worked with Begich Middle School, Lake Otis Elementary, Romig, and Anaka Valley. And we served about 300 students on the bikes this winter and had a great time.
So why is this a big deal for kids? I know I'm a parent too, and I see a lot of adults riding around on these things, but this is kind of a different deal to put the kids on these bikes.
So the great thing about these bikes is they work really well during the winter time with the fat tires, and they kind of float on the snow and they make it easy to ride. And since in Alaska, we have lots of winter usually, the bikes are really great for getting people out and active. Instead of waiting for spring or summer, you can ride all winter long. And so we're getting the word out. We're getting kids out. We want them to get them outdoors and active and on the bikes. And once they get on, they don't want to get off the bikes and they want to keep them. But we say, well, we have to return them to the trailer. Sorry. But they get hooked on it immediately.
So you were telling me before we started talking here a little bit that this is the only program in the country.
It is. We are the very first Fat Tire bike program in the country, and we're very proud of that fact. And 907 and Rasmussen help support us in that program, and we're very happy to have it. And you know, make it an important part of the Alaska landscape.
So you're planning to continue this. Are you planning to grow this program at all?
We are. So we've been out using the bikes all winter long in our outreach programs, after school programs, and now they're going to be used during the summer because they are ridden during the summer and can be, and they work really great on the terrain. And during our summer camp programs at the Campbell Creek Science Center, we're going to have fat tire bike programs, keep on rolling programs, and we're already filled and we're sold out, so they're very popular already.
Wow. So what are the kids saying that have gone out with you? Because this is pretty cool.
they really enjoy it. You can see they're really having a great time on the bikes, and you hear a lot of screaming of joy once they get out, and they're floating on the snow, but they really enjoy it. They say they want to do it again, and as I mentioned, they don't want to get off, and they don't want to end the bike ride, and they want to go out multiple times. Then they tell their parents, and the parents say, you know, these are great bikes, and we will think about getting one.
Very cool. Well, I'm a little jealous myself. I may need to get some of these. So thanks for chatting about this today. How can people find out more about this whole program, and actually even if they have questions about their kids on a fat tire bike?
Sure. We're happy to be a resource about fat tire bikes for kids, and you can go to our website, akcenter.org. We're part of Alaska Center for the Environment, and you go at www.akcenter.org or call 274-KIDS, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions about the program and help you get started with the fat tire bike.
Awesome. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
For links to this story today and all activities on the family calendar, visit alaskapublic.org, and be sure to tune in next month when we'll be ready for summer vacation. For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Erin Kirkland with akonthego.com.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we're talking about geocaching with Scott Saygreaves, Robert Burton, and Mike Malvick. And that's what we're calling you now. But I see Scott smiling. There's aliases that people use for geocaching, right? What, Scott?
Oh, I love the alias names. Good, funny names. My caching name is Fuzzy Belly. It has nothing to do with...
And we're not even going to go. He's wearing a shirt, so we don't really know.
A lot of other.
Where did you come up with that name?
Everybody's got their own way of coming up with a name. My dad is a retired state trooper with a blue uniform, uh-huh. And his radio handle was Blue Belly, and I remember that as a kid. Uh-huh. And since I sell carpet, and it's Fuzzy,
there you go.
And my name's Fuzzy Belly.
Is there like a two-part thing about all the names, or is that just a coincidence? It seems like a lot of them were two things, like Fuzzy. Yeah, two,
no, I think anybody just comes up with their name. And that's Twinkie sort of like Walks is a name.
Twinkie Walks? Okay.
Twinkie Walks, yeah, the Alaska Hillbillies.
Uh-huh.
Tundra Tim, Klondike Kate.
Questing, Cap Sheldon.
So they're not all silly.
No, not all silly. Some don't make sense, or some just put words together, or one word. But I tell you, once you're signing a log very much, you wish you have a shorter name, or you start abbreviating.
Right, because some of those logs are pretty small. Mm-hmm. So, Robert, what's yours?
Ours is just our last name, Burton's, N-A-K.
Okay.
But we abbreviate it BINK.
Okay.
Because it makes it easier on the small nanos that you found with the bolt and the magnetic. So.
And Mike, what's yours?
My family's player account is Ladybug Kids. I've got two young daughters. They were ages 2 and 4 when we started playing, and they were really into ladybugs. So That's how it fit. Now, as time's gone on, it gets abbreviated to just LBK when people are talking to me, just the initials.
Now, for kids, there are these caches that are very, very tiny, and it's just a little scroll of paper, but there's bigger ones that have actual treasures in them, right? And yes. Scott, how does that work? So you find one of these things,
And you take something out, but only if you put something back in?
Yeah, there's tradable items in a lot of them. A lot of the bigger caches, such as ammo cans or a good-sized Tupperware container, mm-hmm. The hider will generally stock it at the beginning when it's first hidden with trinkets or coins, real or just travel coins. And you're welcome. When you find the container, you're welcome to, especially the kids love opening up a container and finding a bunch of toys in it.
So and they're going to be little sort of carnival trinkets.
They could be anything.
It's called swag.
Swag.
Right. Okay. Stuff we all got.
There you
stuff
go.
We all got. Yep.
Yeah, you've got a drawer of it somewhere. Oh, yeah. It came from the penny carnival, right?
Especially as a lot of times there's one special giveaway in a cache right at the very beginning for the person who finds it first.
Something nice.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I mean, it's not like, expensive.
You're not going to make money off
no.
it. No. And what are travel bugs? Is that something too? What does that mean?
Travel bugs or travel coins you might find in caches too, and they have individual tracking numbers to them.
I see.
They're owned by a cacher, mm-hmm. and when you find one, you grab it from one cache, you state that you grabbed it from that cache, and then you drop it into another cache on another adventure.
So it's just seeing where is it going to go to next.
Right. The owner is seeing who picked it up, where it went to, and calculating the miles that it's traveled.
Yeah. And the way that calculation occurs is each one of the trackable items has a 6-digit alphanumeric code that gets logged on the website. And in GroundSpeak's links those logs to Google Earth, so you can click on a link and actually see where the items have gone.
Neat. So another thing that, Mike, you were talking about is there's kind of a collecting aspect of this, because you said you were trying to make it to all the counties in Texas. And I wonder if, like, are there, what are some of the other things that people try to collect in terms of accomplishments?
Well, and this is, you know, Robert during the break talked mm-hmm. about geocaching, something different to different people.
Sure.
So the very basic collecting is number of cache finds. Some people are very competitive about that, and, you know, there are people who have found 100, people who have found 100,000. The next thing is maybe collecting first to finds, being the first one to find that geocache.
Oh, and there are right. some new people, ones that come online and then go out and grab it. I got you. Uh-huh.
And there are some people that will think nothing of doing a 200-mile round-trip drive to beat everybody else to a brand new geocache.
It's out in some remote location, yeah. Uh-huh.
Then there's other things that people will track, such as Robert talked about the difficulty in terrain ratings. Mm-hmm. When you add them all up, there's 81 different difficulty terrain rating, so people will try to finish what's called a fizzy challenge, because Fizzy Magic, a cacher in California, was the first one who came up with the challenges to find a cache with all 81 difficulty and terrain ratings.
How can there be 81 ratings? What is that? I'm not getting you there.
We did get ahead of ourselves. On the difficulty and terrain ratings, every geocache is rated on a scale of 1 to 5 on difficulty and 1 to 5 in terms of terrain. Mm-hmm. A terrain rating of 1 is wheelchair or handicapped accessible. A terrain rating of 5 means special equipment's required, such as a boat or ropes or other items like mm-hmm. that. When I was living in Fairbanks, people debated with me whether my dog team was special equipment. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, you can snow machine to the same place. I can go with the dog team. But and the ratings go in half star increments. So go 1 to 5 in half-star increments, you get 9 difficulty ratings or 9 terrain ratings, and that gives you 81.
Got it, yeah.
Other things that people go for are, there's something called a Jasmer Challenge, which takes you all across the United States to find a cache that was placed in each month geocaching has been in existence. And finding the year 2000 geocaches are really rare. There aren't very many of those. And so to get the May through December 2000 means traveling between Washington State and New York State.
And they're still active after all this time.
Yes. And Alaska's got 2 of the oldest ones still active. The first 2 caches placed in Alaska were in Sitka in September 2000. And so there's a lot of people who book cruises just to come to Sitka to get those old caches.
Well, how about that?
We've done two cruises just for, and with caching, when everybody else is going on the tours, we've already downloaded the maps, figured out what cache we're doing, and gone caching the every port we stop at. And we see more, we tell them about the waterfalls or the fort or something. And where did you see that? We didn't see that on our tour. And we're just so excited.
You're not going to see it from a bus, right?
Right. We see so much more than they actually do.
What a cool way to travel. I mean, what are some exotic places you've been? Robert, have you been at, I mean, you said cruising. Have you been in the Lower 48 looking for them too?
Oh, yes. I've been to the Lower 48, Washington, Oregon, a couple of the other states. I've gone to the Caribbean.
Oh, really?
On several cruises that way, and Canada, several places in Canada we've traveled to.
And it's nice. I mean, I would think if your spouse or significant other wasn't into it, it'd be a lot less. I mean, it's something you could do together. You're not taking off on your own. Scott?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of families do it, husband, wives with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Some, you know.
Put up with it.
Some put up with it. Good.
But I mean,
they're probably not
going to go for a vacation based on that unless they're into it, right? Yeah, you could cause some severe family conflict that way.
You know, you can.
You have fun at the pool. I'm going to go climb that mountain over there.
Which is what happened. I think Mike does that a lot. He gets up early with.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll get up pre-dawn, run around 2 or 3 hours doing my own thing, finding geocaches and places of interest to me, and then the rest of the day is family.
Because you're a little
time.
Bit hardcore, you know. It's one thing to go out to the park, right? But if you're actually looking for these exotic, hard-to-find ones, not everybody would be into that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's geocaching, something different for everybody who plays it.
Yeah. So we're talking about geocaching today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and that was Mike Malvick, who was just speaking. Scott Sagraves and Robert Burton are with us. So are there any issues in terms of, you know, public land access or making sure that you can get to these caches and you have enough place to do it? Mike, is that something that you guys keep track of?
Yeah, probably the fundamental thing is one of the basic groundspeak guidelines is geocaches can't be any closer together than a tenth of a mile or 528 feet.
Oh.
So that's called the proximity guideline. It's to avoid
the
having...
The world's not totally full yet, but yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, but each geocache occupies 20 acres when you the math around that. But the concept behind that is just because a lot of times people think the same location is really cool. So you could potentially have 3 or 4 people try to place a geocache in the same location, and we get confusing about, well, which cache did somebody really actually find?
Right.
Then the other thing is with public land access. Different state and federal land agencies have different policies.
Mm-hmm.
Alaska State Parks has managed geocaches on their lands in South Central Alaska through a blanket permit that Geocache Alaska negotiates with them.
Okay.
The Anchorage Municipality, on the other hand, has a pretty wide open policy. There's no permit required. It's a give and get type relationship. We play on their lands. They like the park visitation numbers to be up, and we clean up parks through our cache and trash out events that are hosted throughout the year.
Oh, nice.
Then moving to another level with the National Park Service, they don't allow physical caches to be left on their lands. It's part of their basic tenet that people don't change the landscape, and leaving a piece of property behind, albeit maintained property, is not something that they support. But they are solidly behind the earth caching concept. So you can go out to Denali Park Road, and there are earth caches along the Denali Park Road that one can hunt. If you go to Yellowstone National Park, you can spend 2 or 3 days doing nothing but the earth caches in that national park.
You'd probably learn a ton about the park if you did that and see some interesting spots.
You sure do. You learn a lot more than what's on the interpretive signs.
Mm-hmm.
And you also, especially in Yellowstone, some of the features highlighted aren't features that are on the newspaper newsletter you pick up when you go in the gate.
I think kids would love that too. That would be a really good way to get kids interested in the outdoors.
I was just in Iceland and made a roundabout stopover in a couple places, Germany and Iceland.
They're doing this all over the world?
It's worldwide. Germany is probably the biggest.
Really?
Most concentrated. And I'm guessing that's what it looks like, pretty close.
I would say in terms of geocaches per square mile, Germany's really pushing it there. Yeah. The United States still leads in terms of number of total geocaches, but our landmass is a lot larger, too.
But when we were there, Iceland has almost, it seemed like when I'm looking at my GPS, deciding which one to go next when we're making the loop tour, there's almost as many earth caches in Iceland as there is regular caches. Mm. And there are also many room for many, many more, because there's things you see, they say, oh, that could be a good earth cache, but I didn't have the time to stop and do anything like that.
Yeah. So what's the, and Mike, I let these guys answer this question, but what's the hardest cache that you've found? I mean, what's the biggest accomplishment in finding it?
Well, I'll answer that with two quick answers. There's the physical challenge, and one of the hardest caches I've done, I did just this last weekend out at the very end of Bird Ridge. It was a 13-mile round-trip hike with 6,800 feet of elevation gain. And to get the coordinates for that, I had to solve, it was a relatively simple internet-based puzzle to get the coordinates for it. So, you know, the people I generally go geocaching with are heading for the high country, and there have been some very physically challenging caches in the Talkeetna Mountains as well. Then in the puzzle category, there's some very tough online puzzles, and probably the most challenging puzzle cache I've done was one in Portugal prior to a trip I did over there that involved stenography, finding the coordinates hidden inside a graphic image that was on the page and required learning about software that breaks photographs apart to get at that baseline data.
Wow. So when you find one of those, do you find like you're hardly anybody's gotten it yet because it's so tough?
Yes. Yes to both counts.
Also, we really love them here in Alaska because of our darkness, we have night caches. And they're put out by other cachers, and what they do is they have little reflector tacks that are put in the trees or the fences and stuff, and so you have to have a bright flashlight and start at a point and you stand there and start shining your flashlights around, and sometimes you have a dozen flashlights flying around, shining all around, and somebody has a real bright one, it gets to the next tack and we see it, and it kind of, they call them fire tacks sometimes, they fluorescent almost when the light hits them, and then you walk there and you do the same thing again, and you can go for 3 hours going from tack to tack.
It's like following the breadcrumbs.
Yes, but it's at nighttime.
And then it brings you to the goal at the end.
Yes.
Through the woods somewhere.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Oh, it's a blast. We look for a new one. We try to find a new one every year or hope somebody puts a new one out every year.
Do you ever put them out yourself?
I have not put a night cache out, but I do a lot of them. And usually it's a group of people that, hey, we're going to go do this night cache. I have a bunch of cachers' phone numbers in my phone, and I just send out a message. We're going to go do this weekend. We're going to go do this night cache. Anybody want to come? And then we all meet up at a certain time at the ground zero, which we call GZ. And then we head on out. And if somebody's late, they call us, and we wait for them. And we have a heck of a time. And it's just so much fun tromping through the snow or even the dry land.
I would think some of these caches would get covered up by snow. Hey, Scott, I mean, that you have to think about whether it's going to be under the snow or not.
Yeah, and actually, when you go to that cache page and each individual cache, when you see the terrain and difficulty rating, there's also attributes that will say, a lot of times people will say either it's winter friendly or it's not. But one of the funnest things to do is to, of course, the ammo can is buried underneath the snow and the log, but I can hear it if I'm probing with my walking stick. So it's just another challenge. That's part of the fun.
So you go for them even if they're not.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. It's wintertime. If I know that it's a big size cache.
Because you're never going to find one of these tiny, tiny ones.
It could be tough. If it's hanging from a tree, maybe I could find it.
Right.
The little bit of snow or a snowstorm just adds to the challenge.
Have you placed any caches?
I've placed a number of caches. I think I've got 40 or 50 caches hidden.
Really? So do you sort of monitor who's found them, how often they get found, and stuff like that?
Every time a cache gets found, the owner gets a notification when the finder logs their find on the website. Then the owner of the cache will get a notification.
Oh, that must be fun.
And that's one neat thing about it is cachers love to hear the stories of the adventure you had when you were out looking for their cache.
So type in a few comments.
Yeah, put a few pictures on it.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
So do they ever just disappear and you have to go replace them?
Yeah, they do go missing. And when you're getting those notifications that somebody found it, it's actually another good thing to do as a cacher is to log that you didn't find it.
Mm-hmm.
And that
we ran into that a few times with my daughter, probably four. We had four in a row that we didn't find.
Well, somebody just stumbles across it and mm-hmm. doesn't know what the game's about, and it's a neat little container, and they put it in their pocket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's no big deal. It's not necessarily stealing. We've put it there for everybody to find, so it just means that you have to go put another one back mm-hmm. in its place.
Yeah.
And the game also bears and squirrels, the squirrels are the worst, they're the smaller ones, because one of the rules is you don't want to put anything, any food or anything with smell to it, because the bear attracts bears and coyotes and the squirrels and the smaller ones, the small film canister size, the tape and the paint on them is they smell it and they think it's like a big pine cone. I keep telling mm-hmm. everybody, and they chew on them or cut the string or
right.
and eventually they'll come up missing or even the wind blowing them. On the trees,
right.
Will disappear.
So but you've mentioned that there's some that have been around for 14 years, and I guess you know we talk about film canisters. Some of our listeners probably don't even know what that is anymore, right?
That's true.
Those haven't been around for a while. How did this game get started? Who, Mike? Do you know the history of it? And when was the very first cache placed?
Yeah, back in May 2000, President Clinton signed an executive order that turned off selective availability, and that's a fancy term for the GPS satellites are in orbit primarily to support military and aviation endeavors. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep clever people with hostile intent from using the same technology, the satellite signal was dithered so that mm-hmm. individuals that owned a handheld GPS had accuracy maybe as good as 100 meters or so.
Yeah.
But in early May 2000, President Clinton signed the executive order for the military to remove selective availability. And so on May 2nd, I think is the date, the accuracy was tuned in and improved for handheld units. And a fellow in the last name of Ulmer went out, hit a 5-gallon bucket of items in the woods outside of Portland, Oregon, posted the coordinates on a geotechnical website, and then the very next day two people went out using their handhelds and the accuracy was good enough they were able to find it
mm-hmm.
and then they started hiding caches. And so about 3 or 4 months after that, Jeremy Irish worked on the predecessor for Groundspeak to create a hosting website for what was originally called the Great Stash Hunt. Stash has another connotation,
right.
And ultimately the term geocache, which combined geo for earth and cache for a container, the game was founded that way in the year 2000.
And then it's grown and grown and grown over time, basically just through word of mouth, and people think it's fun, and so they tell other people about it.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's, and since we're drawing near the end here, let's make sure that folks know how to get involved in this. And we've talked a lot about some of these difficult ones and some puzzles and all that, but if you want to do it, I found you could do it right now. I mean, just you're in your car, you could just download the app or get online, and you could just find your first cache in half an hour. I mean, so step one is to go on the website, right, and you
create a profile on the geocaching.com is the best way to get started.
Mm-hmm.
You're lacking a bit doing it just through a cell phone.
Right.
So the best is go onto the website, create a profile. That'll get you started and allow you to see caches that are available to you.
And then you're going
to
see a map. You can zoom in on Anchorage and see a map of where the caches are located.
Yes, you can.
Right.
You zoom that map in, and I called it a treasure hunting game before, and the caches that are out there will actually show a little treasure box. So you click on that treasure box, and that will bring you to that particular cache page.
All right, and then how do you get the information that you need from there into your device? Go ahead, Scott.
I've got an older GPS, and I'm a little old school on it. I mean, I don't do it advanced ways as others do, but I just plug my GPS right into my laptop, and on the cache page, there's a button that says send it to my GPS. Automatically, that longitude and latitude will be there
mm-hmm.
with a little treasure box.
You say you're old school. I still got a black and white thing, and you'd have to type in the actual lat long, but that would work too. And then
you can
find, right. But on the iPhone, the app will also give you the map. I mean, you can sort of find it on, and then you can somehow or other, at least my daughter figured out how to do this. She's 13, so maybe only.
Yeah, yeah, it's finding a geocache on any smartphone, Android or iPhone-based, is straightforward with the application. Mm-hmm. You get the coordinates with the geocache when you select one from the map, or you can give you a list of nearest caches, and mm-hmm. you can select one based on the difficulty and terrain rating. And so there's no manual coordinate entry, and that's why so many people cache with the phone, especially urban caching in town mm-hmm. or in the cities. The phone works pretty well, but for backcountry, going through the computer to a GPS is the way to go.
Right. Because backcountry, you don't have signal, and so your smartphone won't do it unless you preloaded it in there.
So you got to be within a connection with a cell tower so the phone will actually work.
Correct.
To provide you with the cache page information, mm-hmm. cell phone GPSs will work without
cell towers. If you download it and save it.
I see. Download it and save it.
Because then you're just working off the GPS in your phone.
And the phone is going to tell you which direction to walk and how far it is, and even show a map and a line going to where it is. So the actual zooming in on the spot is not necessarily that hard, but then sort of looking around and finding, because it's only going to get you within, as you said, 10 to 30 feet, and if it's well hidden, you're actually going to...
Yeah, one of the things that we always say is once your phone or your GPS shows you that you're within 15 feet or something, stop looking at your GPS and start looking for the cache.
Right, that actually came right up on the phone. It said, stop looking at the phone.
That's right, did it?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
And once you've been using your phone for a little while and you get, I shouldn't say hooked, but once you get mm-hmm. hooked or into geocaching, many people upgrade to a handheld GPS device over their phones.
Mm-hmm. How much does one of those things cost?
You can get a good GPS unit online via eBay or Amazon or any number of online services for between $150 and on up to $600, mm-hmm. depending on the features you want.
Is there anything special that you want to get in terms of features if you want to be into geocaching?
I think the most important thing is a USB port. Okay. In the original days, not every GPS came with a USB port, and that lets you plug in directly to your computer. And then the other thing that's important is something that supports 500 to 1,000 separate waypoints.
Okay, has plenty of memory.
Is a good starting point. And an onboard memory of several hundred megabytes is good, or the ability to add a memory chip with a few gigabytes of memory on, is especially if you use the handheld GPS to go to the backcountry. There are topographic map sets or navigable city map sets mm-hmm. that you can download to the handheld to get turn-by-turn directions.
So any other kind of...
Paperless, because that way you can download everything you see on the computer mm-hmm. screen, you can see on your handheld device. You don't have to print out the papers telling you about the
right.
Some of the, I don't know, the less expensive ones.
A good size screen, yeah.
Have all the information saved in them. Mm-hmm. And then there are other two things that we really like is wireless transfer. So I'm out with LBK or Fuzzy Belly, and I don't have this cache, and I said, hey, I don't have that one. And so they can push a button and send it to my GPS.
I see.
So it's a wireless transfer. Then the newest thing is, which has really made a difference, is now we're also using Russian satellites the U.S. satellites. So now we just doubled our satellite reception capabilities, uh-huh. which increases our accuracy. But that only works if... makes a difference if somebody else had the same thing, but at least we know a little bit better. They don't wander as much. Yeah.
And we're out of time, but it's if you want to try this, go to alaskapublic.org. All the websites you're looking for will be under today's show, which is on geocaching, obviously. I want to thank Scott Sagraves, Mike Melvick, and Robert Burton. Super enthusiastic. I can see that this is a lot of fun, and I think our listeners are going to have fun if they try it. So, go out and give it a try. You'll find it really is pretty fun. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.